Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
And you're listening to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here at the beginning of the fall. Hope you all had a happy Mid-Autumn Festival / Chuseok. Isn't it strange that the festival is called Mid-Autumn, but it's at the beginning of fall?
Is that what it like directly translates to for you guys? Because like our holiday is like Chuseok, but it's also Helgawi or Hangawi. And that means like Harvest Moon, I'm guessing. So ours is more by like,
I thought yours lunar... also meant mid-autumn. Ours is,
you know what, I'm gonna check, because
ours is literally Zhongqiujie, which is mid-autumn festival.
I don't want to like be a bad Korean and not, the thing is like my family celebrates Chuseok, but they started like actually celebrating it like in the States after I went to college, so it doesn't count. Okay, yeah, so Chuseok means autumn evening, and then Hangawi, which is like a different name for it, also means the great middle of autumn. So
okay, yeah. So yeah, it's essentially the same holiday.
Essentially
I imagine it has the same roots, you know.
Yeah,
probably brought over by Chinese imperialist when we took over your country,
but yeah, it like celebrates the harvest moon though, which is why like we fall, even though it's like mid-autumn, it's it changes.
Isn't
every
that essentially year. What American Thanksgiving is? Isn't Thanksgiving a harvest festival as well, or is that,
I don't know, like Thanksgiving is another holiday where like I don't quite understand it either.
Like I mean, it all corresponds with celebrating the harvest, right? Like you plant your seeds in spring, you harvest throughout the summer, and then in the fall you celebrate the bounties of the land. I imagine like most cultures have something similar. Just depends on what your, you know, what the agricultural cycle is in your country, right?
Yeah, I guess so. And also if you're like indigenous, it's also like a different holiday for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
But yeah, like we pass the most Asian, would you consider it like the most Asian holiday?
It's this and it's the Spring Festival, which is Lunar New Year.
Yeah.
Those are the two big ones.
I feel like with us, like Chuseok is bigger because we get like a 3-day holiday.
Oh.
And it's like the holiday where you go back to your hometown to like, you know, clean up your ancestor's grave and all of that. So.
Oh, yeah, we have one too. That's called Qingmingjie. When is that? I don't remember what it is.
We're such bad Asians. We don't know our own holidays.
I mean, these holidays are all on the lunar calendar, which means it changes every year too. Like, I don't know if any of your parents have birthdays on the lunar calendar. My father has a birthday on the lunar calendar. So every year I need to go check out one of those like Chinese calendars I get from like the local supermarket and find his birthday because it's on a different day each year.
Wow, that's you guys don't celebrate it like in a normal Gregorian calendar?
No. We celebrate it whenever his birthday is in the lunar calendar.
That's so strange. but no, we don't. Yeah, my parents don't do that.
Oh.
Although, like, for like, Chuseok and, like, Lunar New Year, I used to, like, get chastised because they would be like, how do you not know that it's, like, Chuseok, like, or Lunar New Year? And I'm like, I don't know. Maybe it's because it changes every freaking year. And I have, like I'm not responsible.
Yeah, it's one of those childhood immigrant things where I rely on my parents to tell me when these holidays are because they're different each year.
Now you have like apps, but like back in our day,
yeah, now you
needed
it,
like a freaking calendar.
I mean, you can also tell because that's when you start seeing mooncakes coming out at the local Costco. Riri and I both have a local Costco that is a quote unquote Asian Costco. So we get the mooncakes that come out during this time of year.
Yeah, but like mooncakes is Chinese though. Like I was like really upset that like my local H Mart didn't have songtyeon, and I'm just like, oh, it's all mooncakes. It's not Korean. They only care about the Chinese Mid-Autumn Festival. I'm sure other Asian countries like celebrate Mid-Autumn Festival, and they probably feel the same. It's been commandeered.
To be fair, I think it's mostly Chinese people going to H Mart anyways. You're gonna have to go to K-Town for like your...
I know. I'm not driving that far. And also, like, I'm not domestic. I don't want to learn how to make it. I think I learned how to make it in Korean school, but that was like easy because they provided all of the ingredients. Whereas like I'm an adult now and I would have to like make everything from scratch, and I'm not about that life. I mean, I am a millennial. I want like everything prepared for me.
Wait, what is the traditional Korean like treat for Mid-Autumn or Chuseok?
So it's called songpyeon. So it's pretty much like a sticky rice cake that's shaped in like a half moon. I would say like a half moon. So you fill it with like honey and pine nuts. So it's like very sweet. And like all sticky rice cakes, you like steam it. Very different from
That's totally different from a mooncake.
And I'm pretty sure like there's like I think it was songpyeon. Like if you are able to make a really nice songpyeon, like really well shaped songpyeon, like it means that you'll have a pretty daughter. So like, you know, like parents and grandparents are just like, oh, like you need to learn how to make these pretty, otherwise like your daughter or your children won't look attractive. And I'm like, wow, that is like the most Korean thing I've ever heard, where they would put appearance above anything else.
Always love a layer of patriarchy on top of our heritage and traditions. Oh god,
I wonder how much of this conversation's gonna be kept in.
I'll keep it all. Yeah.
Oh wow,
that is to say, props to my dad for decolonizing his birthday. That's all I want to say. But yeah, we're not here to talk about culture and traditions and heritage, although we did just talk about it for like 5 minutes. We are here because we have another great author interview for you. We have author C.B. Lee, who is joining us for the third time on this podcast. We had her on a few years ago to talk about her sidekick series, of which the first book, Not Your Sidekick, was one of our book club picks. We had her back once again at Comic-Con to talk about just authors at Comic-Con. And now we have her back once again to talk about her latest book that just came out this past week, A Clash of Steel, which is part of Fable and Friends' Classics Remix project, where they take classic stories and remix it with a more multicultural lens. So A Clash of Steel is Stevie's take on the classic Robert Louis Stevenson book, Treasure Island.
Yes, it is set in 1826, and it's set during the golden age of piracy around the South China Sea. And one of the characters is based on an actual historical figure, the Chinese pirate queen, Zhang Yixiao, also known as Qing Shi. And it's like very interesting because we don't really... Like, when we think of pirates, we think of, like, Peter Pan's Captain Hook, like, yarg. But Asia had pirates, too. And it sounds like Asian pirates were overachievers.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool to see CB take that piece of history and bring it to life. And, you know, as you hear from our interview, she did a ton of research on this period and like read a lot of historical texts to bring us this story.
Yeah, so I hope you guys all enjoy our talk with CB.
And we're here with CB Lee, the author of A Clash of Steel and a three-peat guest on Books and Boba. Welcome back to the show, CB.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Woo. For those of you who did not listen to our previous episode with CB, she is also the author of the Sidekick Squad series. We talked to her about her first book in the series, Not Your Sidekick. It's super great. Go read it. But we are here to talk to her about her newest book, A Clash of Steel, which comes out September 7th. But it's been a number of years since we've talked to Carrie on this show. So how have you been?
It's been good. It's been exciting to see. Like, this is actually also the 5th year anniversary of Not Your Sidekick coming out. So it's been in, like, you know, it's been such a wonderful journey to have those milestones and to like be able to continue to write stories. And you know, I never thought as a young writer like that, you know, I'd have this opportunity, and I'm just, you know, excited to be here, excited to continue to tell stories in new ways.
Yeah. I mean, like when we started this podcast, it was around the same time Not Your Sidekick came out. So we're both celebrating our 5-year milestone. And it's just great because we're seeing so many debut authors that mm-hmm. we like came across when we first started this podcast. And now they mm-hmm. have like 5-6 books under their belt. And it's like, wow, you guys are veterans now. It's amazing. There's like an actual, like, I remember like when we recorded our previous episode with you, we were joking how you guys were creating a subgenre of Asian American superheroes with like Sarah Kuhn and you and a bunch of other Asian American authors. And I just feel like we've just been expanding what Asian Americans can do in literature. And it's just amazing that a lot of it has come from authors from like 2015, 2016. And it's just been amazing to see everyone grow, including yourself.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been exciting. It's funny because like Sarah Kuhn and I actually met because we both had, so Heroin Complex came out the same year, same summer that Not Your Sidekick did. And so we both were like, hey, you wrote an Asian American superhero and you wrote an Asian. So like, we were both like, oh yes, this is exciting. So it's a very specific like subgenre. Like that series has got like there's so many books in the Heroin Complex series now. It's amazing. And I'm so excited for Sarah and like getting to see so many other authors like have opportunities to like write for Star Wars or like write for like different IPs or to just have so many new spectacular works and like debut authors. Like I feel like every time I turn the corner, there's another debut author who's like, hello, I'm new. And I'm writing this story about like, you know, anything and everything. And I'm like, so excited.
Yeah. I'll say it. Like there's been so much progress since 2015, 2016. You can say it's the awareness that like 2018 brought with all the movies. But I mean, I feel like this momentum's been in books, at least in literature, has been building for way longer than that. Mm-hmm. And
oh yeah, it's been building for a while.
Yeah.
Like I think Ash by Melinda Lowe celebrated a 10-year anniversary. And it's, you know, there's been Asian American writers for, you know, as long as there have been Asian Americans. And so getting to see and celebrate the work that has come before, and like I'm just excited for the future.
Yeah, and you know you have so many more colleagues now in the YA space. It's yeah, it's great. Sure. I think we've been doing a lot of author interviews with YA authors for the last few mm-hmm. months. So I've read so many rom coms, but they're all a lot of fun because they're telling Asian American stories. And mm-hmm. who knew that I would read so many YA rom coms.
I'm just picturing like at book festivals, like the authors kind of like congregate like in like the dining room or whatever. And I'm uh-huh. like, now there's like a table full of Asian American authors. Like before it was like two or three people, and it's like now there's like two, three tables, and it's amazing. So we're here to talk about A Clash of Steel. Can you tell us a little bit about the premise to our listeners?
Sure. So A Clash of Steel is part of the Remix Classics series, which takes on works, you know, literary works that have been known and reimagines them through the lens of different authors. So A Clash of Steel is, you know, is the story about two young girls who are setting off to search for the treasure of Zheng Yisao, who was a real life historical figure. And a total badass. She was like a Chinese pirate legend who's arguably like the most successful pirate in all of history. And I, you know, I took the like sense of adventure and the like, when I say remix, it's not so much of a retelling as a straight up, like I want to like yeet the canon into the sun and, literally like write like, and this is something that like I've talked with other authors in the Remix Classic series about, like what we're doing with our work is that, like, you know, we're looking at these classics and saying, like, you know, why have these been the works that have been lauded as like the canon, or like why are these the works that are lauded as valuable and as a classic, and showcasing a you know, a history that people might not have known is incredibly important to us, and showing that, like, hey, like stories from like marginalized cultures are important. And like, I, you know, I want young readers to feel like they deserve to be recognized, that their stories are valid and worthy of having a legacy.
Yeah. Like, when I first heard about the Remix series, I was reminded of, this debacle that happened a couple of years ago with like the, with a lot of like, American English classics. They were being repackaged so that the covers would have, marginalized characters, but the book was the same. It was just, they were, putting a new shiny cover, and it was just like, well, the content is still the same. The characters are still white, and there are some really problematic things in a lot of these books. So it's nice that there is a chance for marginalized characters to be in these stories, but they're not as problematic. and like Treasure Island is, I don't know why, because like it's such a beloved tale and it's been adapted so many times, and I don't understand it, because like as a child when I was reading it, I'm like, why is this considered a classic? But like, were you the one who picked Treasure Island to remix, or was that assigned to you?
So Emily Settle at 501 Friends from Macmillan reached out to me so with the launch of the Remix Classic series, and you know, asked me to be, if I would be interested in being a part of it. And, you know, I really connected with her vision, and she asked if like I had any particular classic that I felt strongly about that I wanted to remix. And so she presented a number of them, including Treasure Island. And I thought about like what, you know, I'd always been fascinated by pirates. I've especially like had, you know, some information about like Zheng Yisao and her legacy. And I knew immediately that was where I wanted to start. So I was like, if I took, I can make a story out of this, right? Like I can set a story in the South China Sea about the golden age of piracy. And, you know, with my particular identity, it's very like important to me to write about like a young queer Asian girl. And so, starting from there, and that's where I like, you know, this is the one that I feel like I can make a story happen. And so that's where the choice to remix Treasure Island came from. But in terms of like, and the story is a little different for each of the authors, but Emily was like looking out for authors who were interested in remixing classics. And sometimes like there were, you know, sometimes she would have an idea like, oh, you might be a good fit for this one. Do you have an idea? So it's not so much about like being assigned as like Macmillan was like, oh, we're looking for voices who have an interest in doing this kind of project.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was really a big brain genius move to, you know, take Treasure Island is most famous for popularizing the modern conception of what a pirate mm-hmm. looks and talks yeah. like with Long John Silver and his like R's.
Yeah, it's a very romanticized, like, I think that novel really shaped the consciousness of like people's perceptions of pirates and kind of started the whole fascination with like that very like salty language and like, you know, yo ho ho and bottle yeah. of rum and like the very like that spirit of adventure was what made it so popular in the first place, because people were like transported to another world.
Yeah. And, so mm-hmm. the use of like Zheng Yi Sao in this version, which, you know, a lot of people don't know about unless like they've listened to that one episode of like Stuff You Missed in History Class, or maybe went down a Wikipedia rabbit hole, right? They probably mm-hmm. wouldn't know that the Chinese had pirates, mm-hmm. had a big navy at one point in the history, yeah. and like were like the most notorious pirates of the South China Sea, and like the most notorious one is a woman. And I think that's really cool that people who read this book like will probably be surprised that this is an actual real person that you're writing about.
Yeah, like her legacy, like put me on Drunk History, put me on wherever, because I did so much research to like get like learn about her life, and every inch of it, or like every step of it, is fascinating, right? Because she was no one, and then she like married a pirate captain for Sterng, and then like he was the captain of the Red Flag Fleet, and like, you know, at the time, the pirates were all like these like scattered different bands. And so she really took on like a leadership role. And then after his death, which may or may not have been suspicious, right? But, you know, she's a pirate. And so after his death, she started to like, you know, you basically like unite all of these different pirate fleets together, like the yellow flag fleet, the Black Flag Fleet, the, you know, there's different, like at least five different squadrons, and like bring all these lieutenants under her command and like streamlined their like financial, like, like made sure everyone was paid, made sure that like this is how we're gonna like, and like really became such a force to be reckoned with that like there was nowhere you could go in the South China Sea without the pirates say so, right? There's like the British couldn't move their goods. The Americans couldn't, the Portuguese couldn't, and like definitely not the Qing Dynasty. Like the emperor was just like, we need to figure out a way to stop them. And her whole, like her rise to power was so fascinating because it was such a might. Like she, like at the height of her command, she had, you know, literally the force of a small country behind her. And then the rest of her story is just as fascinating because she literally retired from piracy and like went on to die of old age. And like the Chinese government were like, actually, can you like, they were just like, can you stop? Like, can you like, we need you to stop, like give up your ships. And like, she negotiated all these pardons for her lieutenants, and they were like, they got cushy jobs in the Navy. And then she was like, well, actually, I'm going to retire on my terms, and you have to accept these terms. Otherwise, like, you know, what can you do? Right. I'm holding you at siege. You want me to stop, but you know, I'll stop because I want you. And so she like kept a bunch of her ships and like continued to smuggle and run a gambling house. And like, then, you know, settled down and
badass life.
yeah, settled down, became queen of the underworld, and then died of old age. Like, how many like crime lords can you say have died of old age?
Yeah, someone should make like the Godfather movie about her life. That'd be three movies right there.
I'm surprised that there aren't that many adaptations of Zheng Yi Sao, because like she's such a fascinating character. And mm-hmm. also just when we think of pirates, it's right. like Pirates of the Caribbean, right? And
right.
like, I remember, like, was it the third movie where they, like, it was like a round table of just
right. They pirates. Had a character inspired by her.
Yeah, like Mistress Ching or whatever. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I was just like, oh, they're like Asian pirates. They seem to be more interesting. Like, why? Like, why did they make like 5 movies of like the same type of pirates? Well, it's beyond me. Like,
well, didn't they have Chang'e Fat and his whole role being there is to give Keira Knightley a ship?
Yeah, that was.
They fridged
him. Let's not talk about.
They had Chow Yun Fat in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Didn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was totally like the third movie. That.
Yeah, and the entire reason for him being there is to die and give command to Keira Knightley's character.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
I totally forgot that.
They take like the first couple of scenes take place in Singapore, and mm-hmm. you know, like he's kind of shown as like the big bad pirate of like the. Southeast Sea, and it's like, really? Like, there's this badass, like, woman pirate who, like, took over pretty much the trade routes of the 1800s. Like, you're not gonna put her in this film about pirates? It's crazy. But we talked about, like, you briefly mentioned, like, research, how you can be on, like, drunk history and just, like, I just want to ask, like, what was your research process like? Did you look at maps? Did you look at, like, primary sources? Like, what was your process like for researching this book?
It was a lot. I definitely dived into, like, I did a lot of research on the academic side, like, just reading a lot of journals, looking at the footnotes, reading the footnotes of footnotes, and then getting, like, got like out of print books off of eBay. I like read the works of like Asian American scholars who had a particular interest in this time. And, you know, I also looked at like primary documents, and I worked with a translator who could help me like decipher, like I'm looking at maps. Right. And I'm like, what is like that was so helpful. Definitely shout out to Jeanette Wu, who helped me translate a lot of documents and textbooks that otherwise like I would not have been able to add to my research. So there's a lot of helpful information there, and a lot of it too was like understanding the like history, like as I'm like excavating this history, right? It's fascinating how much of it is not like it's such a special interest, right? And if you look online, if you Google like Qing Shi or Zheng Yi Sao, like you're going to see the same like 3, 4, 5 facts cited over and over again, because they're all citing the same person. And they're not like that's what's on Wikipedia. That's what's on like, you know, even the like most famous JSTOR article. But like getting the story behind the story took a lot of work. Like I like just even the like the final siege during like getting to understand what those battles, how those transpired was like the Battle of the Tiger's Mouth, which was like a huge turning point in the like the last days of the Red Banner Fleet, before like a lot of, you know, they were disbanded or people were retiring. I was looking at like historical like documents and journals from like the perspective of the Portuguese, the perspective of the British, the perspective of the Americans, because everyone has a different take, right? Like no one wants to admit that like these like ragtag pirates kick their ass. So they're like, oh, like my, like in this battle, like this many ships were lost, or like this, these were the casualties. I'm like, and then like you read between the, in the lines. So I was like, oh, you actually like lost this battle. But you're spinning it in a way that like you won. And like, there's like, you know, back and forth, right? With like this happened and like piecing together all these different accounts was really challenging, but also a lot of fun. It brought me back to my grad school days where I was just like doing research upon research and hiding out in the library. So definitely took advantage of like JSTOR was free during the pandemic. So definitely took advantage of that. And, you know, going down that rabbit hole of research.
Yeah. It certainly does sound like a rabbit hole.
Well, Zheng Yi Sao is obviously the background of this story, but the story is really about the adventures of Shang, who is your main character. What was the main character of Treasure Island? It was some boring name. Jim right?
Yeah, Shang was a complete, like, is an original character. So, like, the historical figures in the book are, like, Zheng Yi Sao and Zheng Bo Sai. And so, and, like, you know, the, like, you know, actual historical pirates, but everyone else was like invented for the sake of the novel, where I wanted to tell the story about this young girl. And like the, like, you're not going to find, cause this is a remix. It's not a straight up, like, I'm not trying to follow the structural beats of Treasure Island at all. So you're not going to find like, this is the Jim Hawkins character. This is the Long John Silver's character. This is the, you know, I wanted to have, cause once you take the story and you change the setting, you change the main character, like Xiang's desires and journey drive her, like her desire to have more, right? To see beyond what society is expecting of her is what drives her to like go after the treasure, right? And so there's like some nods to Treasure Island where I have like, you know, the tea house burns down and that's kind of like a catalyst for setting off. But like the main character, she really like, I hope that people like enjoy her journey and you know, see that like her you know, her determination, her strength, and like, you know, the it's about finding treasure but also like finding yourself along the way.
Yeah, and I mean you say that you didn't map the characters like one-on-one with the original story, but I did see shades of Long John in your other I guess protagonist on, who is the type of person who's super friendly, but you're never sure if you can trust her. Uh-huh. But I really love that. In my brain, I was like, oh, so CB decided, what if Long John was a girl and also a romance option for the character?
Yeah, I was just like, yeah, sword fighting, but make it gay.
Yes, I love that scene.
With hot, like, girls, yes.
Yes. I think An always like was going to be like this like fun, roguish character, and you get to see like her relationship with Xiang, and like how they like grow to like trust each other, was really fun to write. That's really no one has ever picked like interpreted that as like she's the Long John Silver character. I was like, oh, that's a fun that was, I definitely didn't intend that, but that was like, that could work, sure. I think if anyone is like Long John is more likely An's mother, Captain Hua, because she is the captain, and she like but not so much in the sense that like I don't know. There's a lot there. If yeah, we were to try and map it one-to-one, I don't think it would work. But
yeah, but I was like, oh, so this is the character I'm not going to trust. But then they obviously want to kiss the entire time. Yes. But
yes.
Yeah, the simmer was there, definitely. Yeah, you mentioned Captain Hua, and I was really, well, not surprised, but like, I really like the fact that there were so many different types of female characters, mm-hmm. and it wasn't just all feminine characters. You have characters who, you know, are very, I guess, like, masculine in terms of, like, athleticism and manner, and you have, like, different women captains. It was just really nice to have so many examples of strength, of like women's strength. And mm-hmm. I just want to like ask, like, did you think to like have so many like women in your book? I know that's like an odd question to ask, but it's a book about pirates, but there are so many women captains, and they have like, and they're just like absolute bosses, and that's not something that we usually see in piracy canon.
Yeah, I definitely intentionally wanted to show a lot of different types of strength in captaincy and in being a woman, and that there isn't like a wrong way to be a woman. I think there's, you know, there's the danger of that trope that like, you know, this is the exceptional woman who's strong despite of, or like she's eschewing feminine qualities because of like the masculine qualities are better or whatever. And that's a very specific trope that we see in like films and TV and like where it's like this woman has succeeded because she's the exception to like, she's not like other girls, right? And so I wanted to show like different types of ways to be strong. So we have like Xiang's mother, who is a very shrewd businesswoman, and we have Captain Hua, and we have all the different women on the crew of the Huanvu itself. And so getting to like write the crew was really fun because I have different And I wanted to show also, like, there's different types of, like, you know, you have Ling Shan, who's, like, very skilled with a sword, but she also comes from a background of being a courtier. And then Mian Man, who is a seamstress. And, you know, she takes pride in a lot of, like, skills that were considered, like, very feminine. And even Xiang learns that, like, oh, wow, like, this was really useful. Like, I have a scene where she's talking with her about like embroidery, and like, you know, Xiang had always kind of dismissed these kind of skills as useless, but she was like, oh, you know what, they're not useless, because it takes patience, and there it takes like it like and so I wanted to show how all of these different skills were useful regardless of their background.
Yeah. And knowing you, I had a little chuckle that, like, you included a Vietnamese, like, family in this story, because, you know, you yourself are Chinese Vietnamese. And mm-hmm. I love that you incorporated that, because, like, at this point in history, like, they would have had a lot of contact, and they would have had a lot of, you know, trade within in the sea. And, I mean, was that, I imagine that was something that you,
had to research also.
Yeah. Like, was that something that you, saw this as an opportunity to bring in, like, Vietnamese characters as well?
Yeah. I definitely wanted to have a mix of, like, Chinese and Vietnamese characters. And, like, actually, the rise of piracy in the South China Sea is a direct result of, like it's all interrelated, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the Taizong Rebellion in Vietnam, like, that was what kind of catalyzed, like the Nguyen lords were like, hey, we're going to hook up with these pirates and, like, incorporate them into our navy. And, that was kind of the start of, like, pirates gaining military experience and starting to work together. And then that was kind of the rise of, like, pirates working as fleets. And then after the rebellion, like, they were just like, you know, we have all this experience, and they're going to continue. And that was kind of like the beginning of the rise in piracy. And that's where you get all of these, like, you know, famous figures. That's where Zheng Yi came from. And so he was originally and a bunch of other guys were, like, originally part of that war. And so entangling like and obviously with, like, you know, there's been a lot of conflict and tension, right? Also is, like, these two countries and the resources and people and, like, getting to unpack that and getting to, like, write about, like, different aspects of my identity was really meaningful to me, because I was like, oh, like, I get to explore different parts of my heritage and have multiple characters that reflect that. Was really,
yeah,
great.
You know, I'm thinking about all the, you know, everything we get from, like, Western pirate canon, and mm-hmm. man, I really do want to see more from Asian pirates, because, like, junk ships are cool, and, like, junk ships,
yes,
fighting
they are
really cool too.
They, like, that was a huge advantage. And this is, like, my nerdery coming through, learning about, like, boats and sailing. And one of the things that a junk was better for the area where you have, like, you know, the Pearl River Delta, the Red River Delta, like, all of these, like, the junks were, like, flat bottom ships. So they were very fast. They were very mobile, especially in this environment. And so you have these, like, huge European ships that were, like, literally giant tanks, right? And then they're easily overpowered by these small, tiny ships that were, like, and a lot of the pirates, the fleet was made up of, like, these small ships. Like, yes, there were, like, the larger ones that were literally, like, floating fortresses. I think Zheng Bosai actually built, like, a temple on one of his.
Oh my gosh.
He was very extra. But, like, the junk ship itself is such a, like, an iconic, like, beautiful ship. And it's so, like how did they, how learning how they worked, learning about that, like, the role of this ship and how, what they were capable of was really a great part of the research.
Yeah. When we think of pirates, like, I was just thinking, like when we think of pirates, we think of, like, old pirates, right? Like, from the 1800s, 1700s. But people forget that there are modern pirates. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help but, like, notice in your author's note in the book, you talk about your family and mm-hmm. how they fled pirates. And just like, I'm curious, like, did you talk to your family about those experiences growing up? And did that influence you developing your pirate characters?
Yeah, like, it was definitely a big part. Like, my mother would tell me about, like, you know, after Saigon, she left on a small fishing boat, and it was literally the size of our living room. So, you know, she would break out the story, and like, this was how big the ship was. This is how we were all sitting. There were like 40 to 50 of us crammed into the small boat. And this, one of the stories that was like so fascinating to me was like, when the pirates boarded the ship, they like let all the men off the ship. And so like everyone, all the refugees were terrified, right? They were like, where are all the men going? Are they coming back? Are they going to like kill them? And then the men came back after the pirates had like stolen their stuff. And right, the men came back and they had been fed a hot meal, right? So it was just an interesting, and like my mom would tell me other stories that like, you know, like friends from the refugee camp that like, you know, this boat was attacked by pirates, but this boat was also like saved by pirates. Like they were towed to safety. And so there's a lot of different, like as a kid, right, you're taught that like good and bad, and who are the good guys, who are the bad guys. And so there was never like a clear, like who's a good guy, who's a bad guy in this story, in these stories and these people. Cause they're just, and that really like influenced my thinking about like they're people, right? They're people who had to make choices in a difficult time. And that was kind of the intention I wanted to bring to A Clash of Steel, that I felt like the original Treasure Island did not engage with, because it's a very black and white picture that Robert Louis Stevenson paints of like, these are all the villains in the story, right? And so I wanted to look more about like the individual choices that people were making, and kind of like, you know, look at this like imperialist society that, you know, forced people to become pirates and beggars and thieves.
Yeah, definitely. You see that with like the different pirate characters, because you have like Captain Hua and like the crew, and it's like, oh well, they come from poverty, they're doing this because you know, they tried to make an honest living, but you know, they were unable to feed their bellies. And then you have like these shipmates who are like part of the Navy, and it's just, you know, like I love the fact that there were different levels of like morality, and how it was driven by like personal reasons. But I want to talk about like the Vietnamese culture that's in your book. I thought it was really interesting that you kept like the Vietnamese, I guess like romanization in the book, because you like kept like the Mandarin as like English. So like, what was your decision in like, okay, like this is the language that's going to stay foreign in my book?
So that was primarily, so Xiang's perspective, the book is in Xiang's perspective. It's a first person novel. And so Xiang, I made that choice for her understanding of the world, where she grew up speaking like Cantonese and Mandarin. And so the Vietnamese that appears in the book is like how it would appear to her as, and then as she like learns more about the language, she like starts to have more conversations where she understands what people are saying and take part. But like also the English is all like I don't even write out the English that's spoken, because she has no way to like interpret that as like words. But like that was working with it's interesting writing a novel in English that is meant to be like heard in another language.
Yeah, definitely.
Especially with like my understanding of it. So like I wanted to, and even also like the romanization of the Vietnamese characters, like that's a more modern interpretation, but it felt right to me, because it's like what like the Vietnamese people like chose as their national, like this is how we're going to romanize our characters with the diacritics and stuff. And like, you know, I had a historical note about this too, about like the romanization of Chinese words. I chose a more modern romanization because the old like Wade Giles like system was developed in like the 1800s was a very like Western and colonialized view of like, this is how we're going to spell these places, right? And like those spellings became popular. Like I went down another rabbit hole, like what is the correct spelling of like Sichuan? Right? Do you spell it with a Z? Do you spell it with an S? Like, and that was kind of like like not just Sichuan, but like, you know, the names of places like Guangdong. Do you spell it with a K? Do you spell it with a G? Like, and that all came from like unpacking that kind of like Western lens, right? Because people like there's until like the Chinese government began to like, hey, this is how we're going to romanize these sounds in our language. There was all sorts of differing sounds. And so I felt like that was also part of like a reclaiming where I was like, hey, instead of using the same like spelling that like all these historical maps, there's like different spellings, right? Of like, okay, the Guangdong province here is spelled like K-W-A-N-G. T-U-N-G, because that's what the first like white like settlers and were like, we don't know how to spell this. They said this word to me. That's what it sounds like. That's what I'm going to write on paper.
Yeah. I mean, even to this day, it irks me a little bit that I have to go look for a Peking duck house to get like my Beijing roast duck, yeah. You know?
Yeah. And it comes down to like Buckingham is like the, like the, and how are you going to spell it? How are you going to pronounce it? But it's like, but because that hard, like when you see it's very specific to restaurants, right? Because Peking duck, P-E-K-I-N-G, has what the term has been popularized, right? And it's very interesting too when you look at like the like time period of when the immigrants came over, and that's when they started like naming their dishes. So there's a lot of people who are used to like the spelling of like with the P, right? Yeah. For like Peking duck,
or like Sichuan, like,
yeah, with
yeah, the Z, right? Instead of Sichuan with the S-I.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's really funny because like yesterday I tweeted saying romanization makes absolutely no sense. And
everything is made up.
Everything is made up. And I love the fact that you like mentioned like reclaiming like our language. And yeah, like even though we're romanizing in like the modern sense, it's like, well, we know what it actually sounds like.
And yeah,
we have the authority to romanize it because we're Asian American. Like,
yeah. And that whole like writing this as an Asian American was very like, it felt very meaningful to me, like unpacking like my experience in the diaspora and like, what does it mean for me to be writing this book set during this time? And for like my experience is like, I'm not a mainland Chinese person, I'm not like a full Vietnamese person, but I'm the mix of all these different experiences. So like I'm bringing my perspective to the table, and like I think that's something I don't know, the feeling of being lost or like not quite fitting in is something that I think resonates with people, you know, regardless of if they're part of a diaspora, or like if they're queer, or if they're, you know, in 1826 and want to find more.
Yeah. I mean, you did a great job. The book is so much fun. It's action, adventure, romance, thrilling fight scenes, naval battles. yeah. Congratulations. And this is the first book of the remake classic series, right?
Yes. We also have So Many Beginnings, which is launching the same day. And that is a Little Woman remix by Bethany C. Morrow, and it is amazing. Highly recommend this novel, which takes you know, the four March sisters are now four Black girls living in a free people's colony, and it's wow, absolutely amazing. And then the next book in the series is Travelers Along the Way, which is written by Amina May Safi, and it's you know, you have like a Muslim Robin Hood set during the time of the Crusades.
Wow. This is just so much like, I want Hollywood to take note. This is how you remake a property, just by remixing and not just like giving it the same thing over and over.
That's so amazing. Yeah. I love how we're seeing like historical fiction more from like a marginalized voice. And yeah, like when you look up period pieces on Netflix, it's just all European period pieces.
It's a very specific period.
Yeah, or like, you know, Chinese dramas like the Imperial Palace, and it's like, okay, I can only watch so many of these. Like, I really wish that I could see more. Particularly because I am really into fashion history, and it's like, mm-hmm, I really want to see the cool clothes. Like, where are they? But we are winding down to the end of our time. And I just have to ask you, if you had a pirate ship, what would the ship be called? Because ship names are a big deal.
They are a big deal. It's funny that like okay, so I wrote the novel, and then I was like, oh no, I have to name all these ships. And so that was kind of like the last step, where I named the merchant ship, I named the warship that Zhang Bosai sails, and I named like the Huanwu, so that's actually that's the Vietnamese words for the black tortoise, which is one of the four mythological animals. So that was a specific choice. And then the golden carp is the first ship that Xiang sets her foot on when she's leaving. And I thought that was fun because she's like a carp becomes a dragon. And and then you have the iron wrath, and I definitely had to have a dragon ship in there.
Of course. I mean, this is a book set in Asia. You have to have dragons in there.
If I were to have a ship, I think, I don't know, I would probably name it something fun. Like, because I don't see myself as like, this ship needs to be really badass and fierce.
Yeah. I feel like if CB has a ship, it's going to be a party ship.
I don't know. Maybe I would name my ship like the Round Seal or like something fun and warm and inviting.
Yeah.
That sounds really cool.
Party on the Round Seal.
One day.
Thank you so much for joining us once again on Books and Mobile. I guess, what are you working on right now? Can you plug what's next for you?
Sure. So A Clash of Steel is available now. Feel free to order from any your local bookstore. And then next year in 2022, the last book in the Sidekick Squad series, Not Your Hero, will be out. So that's what I'm working on now, which is, it's been very emotional to write the final chapter in the series. And I'm really thankful for it's fun like we're talking now, because it feels like a bookend of I chatted with you guys at the start with Not Your Sidekick, and then Not Your Hero will be the finishing the story and coming full circle. So that will be out in 2022, and then in 2023, my Coffee Shop in an Alternate Universe novel will be released, which is a contemporary fantasy about two girls who are dating while the multiverse is colliding.
Right. Yeah, we actually just announced that book deal on our last book news episode. So yeah, congratulations on that too.
Thank you. Yeah, it'll be really fun and nerdy. I'm excited about it.
Yeah, I love that you're expanding your genres as well, from post-apocalyptic to historical fiction to contemporary fantasy. I love that I've been able to see you grow as a writer. Just comparing Not Your Sidekick and A Clash of Steel, I mean, they're totally different genres, but I was like, wow, CB has really matured as a writer, and it's just really great to see. And I feel really honored to be a part of your journey, having you on our show and everything.
Yeah. It's been wonderful to be a part of this journey. I think just reflecting on 5 years of the Sidekick Squad and since Not Your Sidekick has come out, it really has been so wonderful to be a part of the Asian American community and how uplifting everybody is about creative work. And I honestly did not expect the book to have the reach that it did. And that in part is possible by amazing folks like you, the Books and Boba podcast, and the amazing folks at Cape, and all the wonderful people who are working hard every day to uplift other voices in our community. And so it's been a great journey. I'm happy to be a part of your journey.
we try our best. Thank you so much for joining us, CB. Good luck on all your future endeavors. And everyone should read Clash of Steel. It's awesome.
Thank you.
All right, and that was our interview with C.B. Lee. Her book, A Clash of Steel, came out this past week, so it's available at booksellers everywhere, so check it out. If you do feel like purchasing it online, might I suggest checking out the Books and Boba Bookshop page, where we feature every book that's ever been on our podcast, as well as a ton of meticulously curated lists by Rira. Purchases on our bookshop.org page does benefit not only us here at Books and Boba, but also your local bookstores. So yeah, check it out. You can check out our bookshop.org page at bookshop.org/shop/booksandboba.
And I highly recommend that if you are planning to purchase books during the holiday season, or, you know, buying books for other people as presents, do it early, because there is a supply chain issue going on right now, and you might not get your book for maybe a month, maybe a little bit over a month. So pre-order and buy books that you really want this holiday season. It is the best way to support independent bookstores and local authors during this trying time.
All right, Rira, remind us what we're reading for the month of September.
We are reading Chemistry by Wiki Wang. Marvin, you've had this on your bookshelf for quite a long time, and it's totally my fault that we did not read it for this book club sooner.
You know what? Better later than never, and I'm super excited to talk to you about this book. It is bringing out a lot of feelings.
Yeah.
There was a time when I did consider doing academia as a career path.
And oh, no way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I did enjoy school, so the idea of doing school forever did sound a little appealing at one point. But, you know, as with any other career, it is one filled with
trials.
Yeah, and tribulations. But yeah, we'll be discussing that book next week on this podcast, so stick around. If you've already finished the book, please let us know your thoughts on our Goodreads forums. And you know what? We should mention now before we forget, but next week will be our 5th anniversary.
Woo!
Yeah, it'll be our 60th book for this podcast, which is wild. Can you imagine?
I mean, think about it, Marvin. Before we started this podcast, you had no books by Asian authors on your bookshelf. And now you have so many.
Them. I have all of them. So many.
It's not even just 60, because you've received books for author interviews as well. So it's way more than 60.
We've read so many books, which is great. I'm glad that I can finally be even though I'm not the most literary person, and say I am a reader.
You are not allowed to say that anymore, because I can guarantee that you've read more books than most people in your circle of friends at this
Probably.
Point.
And on that note, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to C.B. Lee for being our first three-peat guest. And yeah, thanks, Rira, for 5 years of reading.
Yeah. Okay. We'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone. Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu, and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @BooksandBoba, and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
I'm Quincy Cho.
And I'm Kaycon Apu. And we host Marvel Makeup. It's a podcast where I teach Quincy a little about Marvel.
And I teach Kay a little bit about makeup. Join us as we watch and talk about every movie and TV show in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which I'm mostly watching for the first time.
And join us as we apply makeup stuff to our faces, which I'm using for the first time. Marvel Makeup is part of the Potluck Podcast Collective, and you can find new episodes every other Monday wherever you listen to podcasts.
And you can catch video versions of Marvel and Makeup on our YouTube channel. So please rate, review, and subscribe. And please give us 5 stars so our Asian moms will understand why we buy so much electronic equipment.
Because it's for this podcast, Marvel and Makeup.